and gentlemen, it's so great to see so many of you here today. As you know, the motion is This House Believes God Is Dead. Very contentious debate. So if you want to make points, and you can make points during the main speech, wait to be acknowledged by one of the speakers. You'll all get a full opportunity to make floor speeches after the fourth speech. If you could possibly turn your phones off, and please enjoy the debate. The first speaker for the proposition, Professor Simon Blackburn.
Thank you very much. I'd like to start with some words which are not my own. a quotation. Enlightenment is man's release from his self-incurred tutelage. Tutelage is man's inability to make use of his understanding without direction from another. Self-incurred is this tutelage when its cause lies not in lack of reason, but in lack of resolution and courage to use it without direction from another. Sapere aude, have courage to use your own reason. That is the motto of enlightenment. And those are words from Immanuel Kant, writing in 1784, in his famous essay, What is Enlightenment? Dare to think, dare to know, have courage to use your own reason. I'm proud to say that I'm an atheist. I don't believe in the supernatural, and I don't pay any attention to what anybody chooses to tell me about it. Everybody in this room is nearly like me. Everyone shares my attitude to nearly all religions. You do not believe in the Greek gods, or Wodin, or Thor, or Quetzalcoatl, or Osiris, any more than you believe in the Tooth Fairy. I just go one step further. I'm an equal opportunities atheist. I don't discriminate arbitrarily in favour of any one of them. All we can be sure about God, the only thing we can be sure about, is that it is especially men wearing sandals, skirts and beards, who claim to hear him, nearly always a him, especially well. Unfortunately, what they hear strangely varies with what they bring with them. In the 18th century, the Christian God was in favour of the death penalty for poachers, and he was in favour of slavery. In the 19th century, he changed his mind about those things, but was against anaesthetics and the education of women. Now he's against physician-assisted suicide in Britain and against birth control in Italy. According to Stephen Green, who will follow, and who claims to hear him with extraordinary clarity, he's against Jerry Springer, but for the death penalty. According to the chaplain of my college, he isn't. In parts of America, he wants to bring back stoning for women for adultery, and for otherwise risking the family honour. Aha, you say, but I don't believe any of that, and my kind of religion is supported by reason. That's never true. Scholastic theology, in the favourite of the early 18th century, the argument to design, was destroyed by Hume and Kant. If you look at the world about you, which is the only evidence for God's design that there is, you can't infer anything interesting about the designer, except that he or she or they designs worlds like this. You can't get a God who prefers human beings to ants, or heat to cold, or order to disorder, or good to evil. You can't even get a God who rewards believers and punishes disbelievers, as many churchmen have thought. Metaphysically, it's just as likely that there's a God who rewards disbelievers for following their God-given reason and punishes believers for being superstitious. Intellectually, the attack gathered strength in the 19th century. Hume had already showed that it was very unwise to believe in human reports of miraculous events, and as scholarship improved, the historical credentials of the Bible were shown to be feeble, while Darwin destroyed any residue of interest in the argument that nature's wonderful design demonstrated a divine creator. And Feuerbach and Marx gave us plausible explanations of the functions of religion, most of which were sinister, and none of which helped anyone to think of it as true. It really is the most colossal exercise of human vanity to think that the creator of the world, all-powerful, all-good, master of the cosmos, took 14 billion years and made countless billion worlds, especially in order to bring about us. Hello, Gabriel, how's it going? Fine, sir, we got rid of the Mozart model, and now we're road-testing the Pete Doherty. Wittgenstein is often taken, especially in this town, to have prized religion away from offering descriptions of the world. He saw it as doing something else. But what? If people who talk of heaven, for example, and events in heaven, are not describing an exotic part of reality, something like a long-distance part of space with a direction from Earth, what are they doing instead? And there are many suggestions, some compatible with others. They're telling stories, satisfying fictions, promulgating myths. They're taking comfort in an illusion of being able to control events by gaining the favor of the cosmos. They're finding metaphors through which to gain some understanding of the human condition. They're insisting upon or expressing certain emotional reactions to the human condition: hope, desire, rebellion, acceptance. They're performing, analogously to performing dances and songs, or reciting poetry. They may be promoting the old human favourites: self-interest, self-importance, the will to power. They may be affirming tribal identities and separating themselves from others. They may be giving mythical force to their social ethic, a megaphone through which they can shout demands more loudly. They may be giving themselves rights. So let's be absolutely clear. There's no voice in the sky. And even if there were, different people would interpret what it said in their different ways. There's no skyhook. There's no way of ensuring that only good, decent people are in charge of telling us what they take the voices to say. Generally speaking, the reverse may be true, because all too often, people who hear supernatural voices refuse to hear human voices. Nietzsche was surely right to suggest that it is typically from positions of psychological frailty and debility, even collapse, that people take themselves to hear other than human voices. Marx was surely right that it may be from positions of political and economic disability that people need the consolations. Those are sadnesses. They're not something to be, as it were, aggressive about. I wouldn't dream of being aggressive about any aspect of the human condition, especially aspects of the human condition that make people religious. But still, we may need to regret the weaknesses and the political disabilities and the economic disabilities that drive people in those ways. Religions are human inventions, like dances, poems, musical recitals, fairy stories, but also human inventions like prisons, tanks, and guns. Since it's humans who invent religions, we can't be totally optimistic about humanity while being totally pessimistic about human religion. But Wittgenstein was wrong if he thought that by talking of the religious language game, he exempted religions from criticism. When religions impinge on ethics and politics, they play no game, and we must use our own decencies and our own judgments to evaluate them. This is the point of Kant's remark, that we have to free ourselves from tutelage. We have to stand on our own feet. So we come back to the present. Why just now might it be important to talk about the myth, to shake the storyteller away from the story? To my generation, it was unthinkable that Western civilization should need to compete with religion. We had grown up out of the tutelage, out of that childishness. But now it's not only in places of barbarism that religion claims political power. And the religions with political power are mainly badges of pretty dodgy ethics and pretty dodgy national and ethical solidarities. I am, as I say, an equal opportunities atheist, and I include some manifestations of Judaism, right-wing American fundamentalism, and for many of us most seriously, Islam and fundamentalist Christianity in this country, in my skepticism. The voice in these skies tells people to hate the infidel, to be thankful that we are not like them, to claim superiority, to enforce habits of dress or sexuality or education, to police the behaviour of women. It asks people to substitute warfare for perpetual peace, and it gives people a megaphone through which to express these vile emotions. It gives them not only the right, but the duty to bring up their children, for example, to inherit ancestral hatreds. We philosophers, which means only people who try to reflect on these things, which means, I hope, all of you in Cambridge, have a duty to reinvent the Enlightenment concept of reason. And then we have a duty to use reason to suppress storytellers who wish to turn people into reason's enemies. Unless we can accomplish these philosophical tasks, our self-image may not be strong enough to secure victory for the Enlightenment. But, as I say, as Marx said, the task is not only intellectual, but political. We should remember the context of Marx's famous remark in his critique of Hegel's philosophy of right, the remark which is usually taken out of context. So I'll give you the whole passage. Religious suffering is at one and the same time the expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is the demand for their real happiness. To call on them to give up their illusions about their condition is to call on them to give up a condition that requires illusions. The criticism of religion is, therefore, in embryo, the criticism of the veil of tears of which religion is the halo. Well, Marx thought that religion was simply the upshot of deprived social conditions, and in order to eliminate its malevolent influence, you had to eliminate the social conditions. That may not be true. It may be that religion is a more potent force in human life than Marx thought, that it can thrive and flourish and overtake enlightenment in many more varied circumstances than he believed. I don't know about that. I'm not a social scientist, and I don't like to predict the upshot of social change. But what I do think is that by standing on our own feet, by throwing away the skyhooks, we could perhaps make the world one where real happiness supersedes illusory happiness, and where something approaching peace supersedes ancient enmity and ancient certainty. And that is what you, the next generation, have to continue to do. Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, the first speaker in opposition is Stephen Green from Christian Voice.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. It's a great pleasure to be back in the city where I spent three of what I suppose have to be described as a formative years of my life. I'm sure they've contributed quite a lot to my psychological frailty. I'm in engineering. And I should like to say I worked very hard. You're far too quick for me. As the great American humorist Tom Lehrer put it, this is before the days of student loans, of course, bright college days so free from care and strife soon will be sliding down the razor blade of life. Mention of life brings me to a motion like this house believes God is dead. Now you may think it does not much matter to God what this house believes. God is still God, whatever this house says. But I take the view that God is involved in all of life and is therefore concerned with what happens here. That's not an attempt at blackmail, nor an invitation to this house to think more highly of its own importance than it should. Both of those would, I imagine, fall on deaf ears. Thank you. But it is to say, and the proposers have some difficulty with this, that God is not like banished to some spiritual realm in the sky, the psalmist tries to see the salvation of the Lord in the land of the living. There's no pie in the sky when you die there. And of course, central to the Christian faith is the understanding that God did not stay in heaven giving orders, but became one of us, walked this earth as a man. So the Apostle John says, we beheld his glory. And Peter told him, you are the Son of the living God. So as Christ was God incarnate in his time on earth, when he was crucified and died to bear the sins of all who would believe in him, reconciling us to God, then between that time and his glorious resurrection, God was, in a sense, dead. But Christ rose from the dead, appeared to numerous witnesses, and ascended back to heaven, truly and victoriously, the Son of the living God. Now, this motion that God is dead is, of course, a quote from the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. I'm sorry, but I can never think of Nietzsche without calling to mind the Monty Python Philosopher's Song. Don't get me started on The Life of Brian, no, Dennis, no, please. Okay. The Pythons had the idea that the great philosophers, those to whom we doff our caps and humbly bow, those whom the Apostle Paul, himself the cleverest guy in the class, condemned as ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth, were not so much thinkers as drinkers. Sartre's famous dictum was rendered, I drink, therefore I am. Aristotle helpfully rhymed with bottle, Hume with consume, Kant with ant. As for the one who coined the phrase, God is dead, there's nothing Nietzsche couldn't teach you about the raising of the wrist. Socrates himself was permanent. I think I'll stop there. Now, I think the reason why the proposition didn't quote Nietzsche but quoted Kant and Marx instead and give the context of the motion is that there's rather more in it for our side than for Professor Blackburn's. In the quote, as we shall see, Nietzsche is saying that modern man has rejected God as a source of any moral code. In that limited sense, the opposition must agree with the motion. Yes, we've done that. And then there would not be much of a debate, and we could all repair to the bar, and you could put the Python version of Sartre's blinding revelation to the test. But we on this side want to say, yes, that's what's happened, but it brings so many problems that God must, in our society, live again as a source of objective right and wrong, of morality. Here's the quote put by Nietzsche into the mouth of the madman. God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to invent? Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of it? So Nietzsche's is the cry of despair, of relativism, of nihilism. And when he says, must we ourselves not become gods, he's remembering Satan's temptation of Adam and Eve. Ye shall be as gods, deciding good and evil. So in rejecting God, we necessarily presume to become gods. And we shall do that either individually or corporately, or both. If, as a source of morality, we remain content to have killed the sovereign Lord, then either the self or the state will become God. That means either a feral kid with a knife deciding his own morality, or an autonomous House of Commons on a Friday afternoon, or, as we seem to have now, a combination of both. So, which do you prefer? Your choice is a rampant individualism, where self-interest trumps self-denial, where someone's right to be crass takes down with it everyone's cultural environment, where selfishness beats self-respect, and perceived self-fulfillment leaves any sense of duty stillborn. you might prefer an increasingly dominant state, where morality is decided by an establishment elite.
On that point?
Go on.
So, are you actually attacking the principle of delegative democracy? I mean, it's not an over-encroaching state we're talking about. We vote for people to decide laws for us. This is what happens now. This is not rampant collectivism. This is reality.
I find it rather naive. I think that Gordon Brown becomes God. The gourd giveth.
Point of information.
And the, no, I thought we had one. And the gourd giveth, and the gourd taketh away. It seems to me that he giveth foot and mouth, and he taketh away your civil liberties. As law and order break down, because the godless individual is a law unto himself, the state will be ever more repressive. You'll have your chance. And will cast those who oppose things like detention without trial, trial without a jury, summary execution of Brazilian electricians, as the enemies of law and order. The idea that they might be the guardians of God-given freedoms does not occur. In fact, the concept that we have our freedom, our liberty, as God-given, is lost as the mighty state hands down state-determined rights to its populace, of its wonderful largesse and mercy. So I'm saying that what goes out with the death of God, contrary to what Professor Blackman said, is any sense of humility. Ye shall be as gods. We must become gods.
On that point?
Go on.
Are you truly saying that you don't murder people only because God doesn't tell you to?
I don't begin to understand the question. I'm so sorry. The boy... Well, I'll tell you. The boy who kills for a mobile phone shares with our leading politicians a rejection of humility and a donning of the cloak of arrogance and the belt of complacency. That's what I'm saying. He is his own God. And if you dare to ask him why he did it, his answer would reflect contempt for other human beings whom God says are made in his image. When David Blunkett was caught using the taxpayers' money to ferry another man's wife to their trysting place, someone told me his personal morality didn't matter as long as he was a good politician. I mean, what does that mean? A good liar? Reject God, and you reject the idea that leaders should be able men such as fear God, you know, God, men of truth, hating covetousness. You'll get avaricious men, corrupt ministers, prime ministers' wives blatantly on the make, men who lie to their wives in committing adultery, good politicians, every single one of them.
Let's just get this straight. Are you saying that there is no source of morality other than religion? Because that's what I seem to get from your speech.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, and that's what Nietzsche seems to be saying. To me, at any rate. I may be wrong. I'm not just a simple South London boy. But that's what it seems to me. Should we go? I'm quite upset my flow there. If you kill God, there is another result of the death of God, is that thou shalt not kill goes the same way. You see, without God, there's not greater peace and respect for human life, but less. Even Nietzsche saw that, and exactly that was his challenge. And they tell me religion causes wars, but we've killed, along with God, more people in the previous century in the name, not of religion, unless you count fascism and communism as surrogate religions, which I suppose a case can be made. I could do that. You know I could. But in the name of man, than in all previous centuries combined. So, you know, what now? We can stay with a dead God going down the same road. And I think our society will end up the same as every previous society that has killed God, that has rejected monotheism for an anything-goes morality. And, no, not just at the moment, thanks. No. The professor seemed to me to be terrified of Islam, and Islam was not something that was particularly the flavour of the month with him. That might be fair, isn't it? But it seems to me that
point of order.
Go on, yeah.
Point of information. I put it in the same breath as Judaism, Christianity, American Christianity, and English fundamental Christianity.
Oh right, okay.
So right. I may be terrified of all of them, but I'm.
Oh, okay. You're terrified of all of them.
I'm an equal opportunity.
Right. Okay. That's fine. But you see, with its fierce monotheism, its sexual probity, its respect for elders, its enthusiastic procreation, its self-confidence, its contempt for Western society and scorn for our values, Islam seems a safe bet to take over from Christianity, what's left of Christianity, secular humanism or whatever, in 20 or 30 years' time. And I don't think any of us, those who survive, will like it very much. So my challenge to the atheists, I don't believe that some... No, I'm being really hard on it, sorry about that. I think the atheist side have to choose Christianity, the historic faith of these arts, or Islam. Because I don't think that atheism...
This is rather an important point.
Go on, then.
This debate is not about this house believes Christianity is dead, it's about this house believes God is dead, and God embraces Islamic God as well as Christian God. So your arguments are actually arguments on our side.
Well, I'm not sure that they are. I was going to challenge you to I don't think atheism has the spiritual muscle to stand up to Islam, because I believe. No, I've taken a couple of points. I don't think atheism has that spiritual muscle. I think atheism, at its core, well, it's obviously godless, and I don't think it has. The kind of vibrancy that Islam has, or the kind of vibrancy that Christianity had.
On that point,
and
atheism doesn't claim to have vibrancy. It's not a form of decoration. It's a way of viewing the world.
Okay, fair enough. So if God remains dead, this is coming back to Nietzsche, if God remains dead, I don't think that's something to be, pleased about. I don't think Nietzsche was pleased about it. I think he was challenging atheists to come up with a moral code, which I believe that he saw as pretty difficult. He says himself that if you reject God, it's not going to be peaceful. It's not going to be this wonderful idea that the professor had that would make the world without religion, the world be happier, and it's all going to be happy valley, because everybody who's not happy is going to be put to death. I suppose in Monty Python, bring back Monty Python again, please. But it's going to be a more vicious, it's going to be a more violent society, and we're seeing it at the moment. From the kid on the council estate, killing because somebody's dissed his mother, to what we do in the abortion clinics in this land. We kill the innocent there, and that grieves me to my heart. And if I sound angry about that, it's because I am. Children killed in what should be the safest place on God's earth. And that is because of the secular humanist philosophy, which is supplied in Christianity. So, you can remain satisfied that God is dead. There is no, problem. I don't have a problem. But, no, I'm winding up now, actually. But if this house does reject Nietzsche's nihilism and decides that God had better not be dead, then I think there's some hope for us. Otherwise, I suppose I'll just have to make sure my passport's kept up to date. And with that, Mr. President, I oppose the motion.
Thank you very much. The next speaker in proposition of the motion is Rahul Nandkishore. He's a debater, and anyone interested in debating can speak to him after the debate.
Long years ago, we made a tryst with destiny. And now the time comes when we shall redeem that pledge, not wholly or in full measure, but very substantially. A time comes that comes but rarely in the history of the nation, when the soul of a people, long suppressed, finds utterance. Thus spoke Jawaharlal Nehru, first Prime Minister of independent India, on the eve of Indian independence. And I would like to take his words as an inspiration for all of us today, because what he spoke of in reference to the awakening of India, I would like to see as applying equally well to the awakening of us all. I would compare God in the debate today to a walking stick that we have used for most of human history. But it is the walking stick that we now no longer need, because we can stand on our own feet. And to throw away this walking stick will prove an immensely liberating, in my opinion, experience. So how am I going to go about trying to put across my case? Well, firstly, I'm going to make a plea for open-mindedness from the audience. Secondly, I'm going to address some of the comments my Monty Python fan friend on the other side of the house brought up, to demonstrate that, well, we don't actually need the walking stick of God anymore. And finally, I'm going to argue that it will, in fact, be an extremely liberating and enlightening experience to dispense with this unnecessary tool. So, firstly, my plea for open-mindedness. I would urge the House, irrespective of their own opinion, to approach this debate impartially and from a scientific perspective. Let's examine that in a little more detail. It is central to science that whatever we believe should be falsifiable, right? Any hypothesis is only a valid hypothesis if it could, in principle, be falsified. Now, on this side of the house, we are saying we believe that God is dead. That is a hypothesis that can be falsified. If three of us were to be suddenly struck by lightning and God were to appear in this room, I think most of us would consider that the strong objective evidence that God did in fact exist. I did not like what I was saying. The other side of the house would have you believe that God does exist. The only problem with that position is that it's impossible to falsify. I cannot conceive of any mechanism by which you could conclusively say God does not exist. Therefore, in the absence of any convincing logic or any convincing proof as to whether God does exist or doesn't exist, the scientifically correct approach would be to take the position that is falsifiable, i.e. to start on our side of the house. That is my plea to the audience. Start on our side of the house because we embrace the possibility that we could be wrong.
A point of information, Robert.
Yes, Matthew.
This is a scientific question. Facts, in fact, of logical positivism, which is the position of Bertrand Russell or the early Wittgenstein, whom, in fact, Popper himself was arguing against, the guy who has thought up this false
philosophy. Matthew, you know more philosophy than I do. I don't know what logical positivism means. I just think it makes more sense to start off bearing in mind the fact that we can be wrong than to start off taking a position where we say, look, there's no possible way I can be proved wrong. Because if you start off on that side of the house, then nothing we say can possibly convince you beyond a doubt that, in fact, you should be on our side of the house. Whereas if you start off believing, denying, that God is dead, then, you know, the other side might be able to convince you.
On that point,
no. Deny.
So, I'll get you later.
I look forward to it. My first point is that we should all really be starting on this side of the house from the premise that God is dead. And then we can explore this idea further in the debate. Now to address some of the points that my friend... I've forgotten your name. Do you have the...
Stephen.
To bring up some of the points that Stephen brought up. Now Stephen seemed to suggest that religion was the only source of morality. In fact, that is what he suggested, because I asked him and he confirmed it. Now, most of us would believe that that is not true. There are other sources of morality other than religion. I am not a religious man. I do not believe that I am amoral. I do feel that I would not murder another human being, even though I have no belief in God. And if you honestly believe that everyone who is an atheist, or who does not believe in God, or who denies the existence of a God, is a potential murderer, one with no moral code whatsoever, then I guess you have to vote with them. But I hope not very many of you here tonight are in that boat. Now, at the same time, as it is possible to derive morality from sources other than religion, people also commit horrible crimes in the name of religion. Now, I don't want to go through the whole roster of Spanish Inquisition and all that, because that gets a frightfully shrill debate. And really, I don't want to go there. All I wanted to do is to point out that it's not self-evidently true that an irreligious society is an amoral one,
and a religious society is one where there is no crime, nobody does anything immoral, and everybody behaves according to the rules, which I felt is what the first speaker on the proposition was suggesting.
On that point, sir, are you talking about morals or are you talking about man-made laws? Because you talk about crimes and you talk about immorality.
I'm talking about both. Even in religious societies, people break the moral codes. And people make up their own minds on what's moral or not. They may have religious guidelines or they may not. At the end of the day, they still make up their own minds. Yes? And I don't see it as following self-evidently that a religious society is necessarily a more moral or a more law-abiding one, which is what the first speaker on the opposition side seemed to believe. I can't take so many points of information. Now, another argument that is frequently advanced by that side of the house, and they haven't yet, but maybe they will, so I'll address it preemptively.
That's a preemptive strike.
It's an argument based on anthropic principle, an argument of some sort on the grounds that, look, you know, the universe is so wonderful, it's so obviously designed for us, it had to have had a designer. Now, I once met a very nice old gentleman who came up with the most succinct summary of this position that I have ever come across. And he said to me that, look, God has to exist because of the beauty of the cosmos, because it's so incredible that the Earth should go around on its axis exactly once every 24 hours to coincide exactly with one day. And it's going around the sun exactly once every 365 days, coinciding exactly with one year. This amazing coincidence meant that God clearly had to exist. Most anthropic arguments boil down to that sort of reasoning, if you dissect them closely enough. And this was my preemptive rebuttal to the anthropic argument. Now, for much of human history, people have believed in God. I know that. I talked about it as, you know, a walking stick, something we all grew up with before we could walk by ourselves. And there's a very good reason for that. It's because the universe is a very mysterious place. Look at the enormous complexity and the beauty of life, and one cannot but wonder, how did the world come to be so magnificent, so wonderful, so complex? And for most of human history, we haven't really had an answer. Therefore, God made it so, was a reasonable first guess answer. Now, we do have answers. We have proper answers, we have better answers, and those answers come from science. I am a scientist, and I'm not ashamed of the fact. Religious people often say that science somehow removes the mystery and the magic from the natural world. Now, I don't see that at all. If you look at, I don't know, the flight of birds from a religious perspective, and you think, well, God made them that way, and they're flying, and maybe that's very beautiful, and that's true. But you look at the same birds from a scientific perspective, and you think of them as, on the first level, lots, millions, billions, trillions of cells moving together, cooperating, so as to produce this flying bird. On the next level of sophistication, you think of it as individual proteins interacting to produce each cell, itself a chemical creation of unbelievable complexity, and then think of sort of protons, neutrons, electrons, and so forth, going into the folding of those proteins. This fantastic complexity, this miraculous beauty that goes into the world. And I just think that's such an amazingly beautiful way of looking at the world that I cannot understand why anybody would say that this way of looking at the world somehow lacks meaning or that it lacks beauty. I think an approach in which you look at the world and appreciate its magnificent complexity for what it truly is, instead of taking recourse in a God made it this way, is a far more fulfilling and a far more beautiful way of looking at the world than the opposition side. I'm sure they would say I am wrong. Yeah, go ahead.
When you take the scientific method to be your mode of investigation, you make assumptions. And this is especially apt because I believe I've actually seen you in mathematics as opposed to science.
Yeah.
A mathematician, even more than a scientist, uses his intuition.
Can I have the question, please?
Well, some things are taken to be self-evident. The mathematician takes this to be the starting point.
Can we still have the question, please?
Your counter-argument is basically that the thing they take to be self-evident is not something that you can. Nevertheless, you do so, and you are using that as your starting point. But is this not the case?
I don't actually understand what you're asking. Please, can you rephrase it in two sentences?
The scientific method assumes something. You seem to be ignoring that completely and totally. Is this not the case?
I still don't understand the question.
You have to have an axiom.
That's the basis of your science. You have to have some axioms at some point.
Are the assumptions of science justified?
Ah, right, fine. Well,
the assumptions of science are justified. No, I've already taken a very long point. I'm not taking another just yet. So this brings me on to my final point, which is that to get rid of this walking stick, this crutch of God that we have for so long relied on, can be an extremely liberating experience. Because I frankly believe that we are perfect. And we can do whatever we want to if we set our minds to it. We sit in the Cambridge Union. In Cambridge, Isaac Newton Isaac Newton, to my mind, is the greatest intellect, the greatest human being ever to exist on the earth. And I find
Bigger than Nietzsche, definitely.
And I find somehow the idea that all of Newton's doings or all of Shakespeare's doings or whatever were purely the work of some celestial puppeteer, rather degrading.
On that point?
Newton was a man. He was a human being like us. And so was Shakespeare. So was Mandela. So was any great human being whom you idolize and admire. They were no different to us. Except they were great. And we too can be. Can be great if we cease to lean on the crutch of religion and learn to stand on our two feet. To illustrate this argument, I would draw from James Joyce's novel, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Now, in the novel, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, James Joyce describes the life of Stephen Dedalus, a young Irish boy. It's considered autobiographical by James Joyce. And Stephen Dedalus has periods in his life when he's influenced by many different influences, including, of course, the influence of religion. Except the one influence that continues to guide him throughout is the influence of his art. Stephen Dedalus is a writer. And gradually he casts off all the shackles that constrain him, all these other influences of, you know, religion and nationalism and so forth, until at the end, I think the second last line of the novel, Stephen Dedalus proclaims that I go forth to experience for the millionth time the reality of experience and to forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race. Now, that's rather heavy quotation, so I shall try and construct it a little. Stephen Dedalus is arguing that he is seeking to experience the world, to encounter the reality of experience, which he contrasts with the illusions of religion and the nationalist influences and so forth that affect his life, and to forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race, simply to take his life into his own hands, to fulfill his own ambitions, his own highest dreams, aspirations, whatever. Now, I believe this is something we should all aspire to do, to fulfill our own higher selves, highest selves, not because some god wills it, but because we owe it to ourselves.
Point of impression?
Yes.
What for those who don't choose to do that?
Well, I think they should.
You think they should?
And they can make up their own minds. But
I mean, supposing they refuse, I mean, what would be the penalty?
There wouldn't be one. I mean, I'm not arguing that anybody owes it to anybody else or to any god to try and fulfill their highest aspirations. They owe it to themselves. And that is the crux of my argument. We should stop leaning on the crutch of religion to say, I must do this because God wills me to do this. But instead say, I must do this because I owe it to myself, because this is the kind of life that I want to lead. And I think that's a very liberating and a very enlightening and a very empowering philosophy to have. And that ultimately explains why I'm standing on this side of the debate. So, to sum up. First of all, the only falsifiable approach to take is to start off by assuming that God is dead, does not exist, whatever. Because if you start off on this side of the house, then you can be proved wrong. If you start off on that side of the house, you can't be proved wrong. Secondly, we do not need the existence of a God. We certainly do not need the existence of a God to have a viable system of morals. And we do not need the existence of a God to explain the universe. And we do not need the existence of a God to give meaning to life. Indeed, I have argued that I believe that a logical way of looking at life is far more inspiring for me. And finally, I have argued that to cast aside the crutch of belief in a God, the crutch of the idea that everything you do, the life that you live, should be lived for someone else, something else, is a very liberating concept. I fundamentally believe we should all... I fundamentally believe we should all live our lives for our own sake, to fulfill ourselves, rather than to do the duty of some celestial being, interpreted however. And on that note, I beg to propose the motion, the question is gone today.
Thank you very much. And I'll remind everyone, you'll have your own opportunity to make your own contribution in the floor speeches of the fourth speaker. So, without further ado, I call Dr. Malcolm Green.
Thank you. Thank you. I particularly enjoyed the peroration you gave to your speech there. It was great to hear an atheist give such a profound credo and use so often the terms "I fundamentally believe." The question of belief, the question which was being asked over there of a priori assumption, is a really serious one. And in fact, I would say that both sides are contending for something which has to have a first assumption. That first assumption, we can say, now what kind of a picture of the world does this assumption give me? Does this open up possibilities? Does it allow me to explore? Does it give me new perspectives? Or does it begin in a closed and narrow way? And actually, I would say that although we're the opposition to the motion, this has to be that God is dead, the positive view that we are taking, that there is a God, not a God understandable by human reason, not a God to be confined by any particular set of concepts, perhaps a mystery behind every manifestation, is actually ultimately a more open-minded position than to begin with the presupposition that we already know what's not there. We actually should be interested, the whole thrust of science is precisely being open to the newness of experience. So I find it in some respects quite unscientific to begin with an argument from silence. But before I deal with that, I actually want to just begin with a personal reflection, which is this. Having heard those very eloquent and, I think, in many respects, just criticisms of the uses and abuses of religion of all sorts over the course of the centuries, and actually, in some respects, perhaps even having heard some of the points made on this side of the house, I have to say, thank God I'm defending God and not religion. I want actually to, in some positive terms, to make an appeal in really quite a different way. We've had a great deal about reason, which is a very proper and noble human capacity, and I think it's one of the great achievements of the Enlightenment that it was progressed forward in the way that it was. But it is not the whole of how it is we come to know reality. There's a very nice phrase in Midsummer Night's Dream,
when Duke Theseus says, imagination apprehends more than cool reason ever comprehends. And that's a very interesting scale we might have between apprehension of truth at one end and comprehension of the other. And I think we all have that experience. We have glimmerings, we have apprehensions, we have intuitions. Now, some of these may be delusory, but others actually may be really key leadings into the nature of reality. And part of our effort as human beings is to somehow bring apprehension and comprehension together into a world. And there are various ways of doing that. Making models within scientific models is a way of trying to get at, as it were, the great scientific model makers, the great genii of whom we've heard, Newton would be one, Einstein another, often, as it were, make a leap of imagination. They have an apprehension of something, and then they begin to model it. And the thing they apprehended was almost incomprehensible at first, but they begin to bring it into comprehension. So I'm very suspicious of any kind of rhetoric that says things like, we just heard speaking, we have all the answers and we have them all right and we now have the proper scientific answers and we can do without these other things. I think there is always an open hinterland of the not yet knowable. And I think that we need, whatever we decide, we need, as it were, a proper humility towards the mystery of being. And I think that should be part both of science and of religion. And I think signally, particularly in the 19th century, both science and religion failed in that humility. And they have something to learn from one another. And that leads to a particular thing about what we've heard about enlightenment. I do want to redress a balance. I was very glad to hear Professor Blackburn quoting that wonderful dictum of Kant's that we should dare to know. Pariade, that's vital. But I'd like to just raise some questions about that great Enlightenment phrase about tutelage, about we are emerging from our tutelage. That's a rather posh way of saying we're grown up. We're very grown up indeed. We've passed the childhood of our age, and now we are going into the full mature adulthood in which we, surprisingly, in our own generation, have actually achieved total maturity. I've got a problem with that. I've got a problem with the whole mythos, the whole grand narrative of enlightenment, of steady progression. The idea that somehow, by coincidence, the generation of which we're happy members have a greater knowledge, a greater maturity, a greater understanding of the world than the countless generations, not only in history but in prehistory, of whom we know nothing. And I'll notice another thing that goes on. It's not only we, it's not even we, all of us, on the face of the earth at this time. Funnily enough, it's we in the West. Funnily enough, it's we not only just in the West, but in Western universities. And then it turns out to be we in Western universities with a particular Enlightenment tradition. We are the truly grown-up people. And what follows? Well, you can see it in lots of Enlightenment writing in the 19th and on into the 20th centuries. You then get the idea, look at those primitive people over there. Look at those primitive Aborigines and those dodgy little tribes in the rainforest. And, of course, all those African people that, if we are grown up because we've read Kant, and, you know, they, by, you know, simple error, failed to read Kant, they atheist narrative is about growing up, but unfortunately it's fused with another narrative. And that whole myth-making, there's a serious side to it, sadly, where you think of the Africans, you think of the indigenous peoples as childish, childlike, children to be grown up, to be educated, but also, as happens to children in our society, children to be exploited. The grown-up with power and ideas that work and give results is privileged over the child. Now that just gives me pause. Yeah. It makes me feel wary. Now one reason why it makes me feel wary is that the religious teacher who inspires me, and I'm a Christian priest, so this is the well from which I draw my water, but I don't think it's the only tradition with a deep bore into the prime truths. But the one whom I follow was very countercultural in his own age, by privileging the child and the childlike, by saying to the grown-ups who were being very, very grown-up, because they thought they were enlightened then, and they thought they'd got the latest thing, and he said, unless you become a child, you won't inherit the kingdom. The kingdom belongs to such as these. And it seems to me there's something very profound going on there, that there are insights given to us in our childhood which the adult ignores at their peril. So a narrative that we have, that we are the grown-ups of the world and that we can forget the childhood of the world, may get us into deep trouble. So the God of whom I speak is not simply the ideological construct of certain religions which can be used to exploit, and there's no doubt that it has been. The God of whom I speak is the one whom we almost see or glimpse in childhood, the one whom we intuit, the one of whom poetry speaks, the one who breathes through music. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't also accounts to be made in science of poetry and music, but I'm saying they're never final. To be on the side of this side of the house is to say a reductive account which excludes God a priori can never be a complete account, so, and is certainly not a humble one. I can take a point of information if you
we've
like.
We've never contended to deny any aspect of the grandeur of the universe. However, you've defined God so broadly, like the moment of awe you feel in music or painting or science or anything, that nobody in the world could argue against it. I think that's far too broad an interpretation for this debate.
Well, I beg to differ there, because you were talking, you used, and very interestingly, you borrowed from Karl Popper in that wonderful book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, the notion of falsifiability. Now, in context, Popper is saying there are certain things which, to be useful and accurate, have to be very narrow. We're interested, when we're doing a particular kind of science, in a certain kind of exact falsifiability in order to make a useful statement. And we need it to be narrow, precisely because the thing with which the science deals, is there going to be precipitation in Manchester tomorrow? Falsifiable question, if you make a statement. That is narrow and specific. The definition must meet. But I'm afraid, I disagree completely, I don't think our understanding of God can ever be broad enough. Because as broad as the broadest human mind will ever be, it will only still be a tiny sliver in comparison with the cosmos which we believe God to have created. I'm arguing for openness and for intuition rather than for narrowness. I have a little note here which tells me how many minutes I've had, so there we are. I'd like to just, since I see I'm down on the bill as a poet, I'd like to just close with, I suppose, a couple of comments from poets. I've already mentioned that great line in Shakespeare about imagination apprehends more than cool reason ever comprehends. The great poet Blake and Prophet, writing in the midst of the great Enlightenment endeavour, but aware of its drawbacks, he said a couple of pertinent things here. One, in spite of that, I loved your praise of Newton, but I have to say that Coleridge said that it would take the souls of at least 50 Newtons to make half the soul of Shakespeare in terms of understanding well. But I won't go there. Blake said a very interesting thing. He said, a time is going to come when you will see the sunrise and they will say to you, do you not see a round disk of fire somewhat the size of a guinea? You must say, no. I see the innumerable hosts of heaven crying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. Now, I'm not saying that the current scientific view of the sun is that it's a round disk of fire somewhat the size of a guinea, but I am saying that I don't think any account of the physicality of things and their causality, what Aristotle called efficient cause, is ever going to be adequate unless complemented, redressed, balanced by this more intuitive account of another truth that shines through the physical. I'm not arguing against the achievements of an Enlightenment scientific analysis. I'm simply arguing that they should be put in place with other considerations, one of which is the intuition or apprehension of that mystery which we call God. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, now you have an opportunity to contribute to the debate. These are floor speeches, and if you could keep your contribution to 1 or 2 minutes at the most. Therefore, anyone who wants to speak in proposition of the motion. Yes, please. Name and college.
Madeline Dixon, Clare College. I think the first speaker for the opposition actually made a very convincing case for the proposition, in the sense that you painted an extremely bleak picture of the kind of society we would have if God is indeed dead. You said that we'd all be murderers and vagabonds, and that suggests to me that the belief in God is in fact born out of fear and a desire for social control and the preservation of law and order, which is exactly what Professor Blackburn was asserting in his speech.
Any speakers in opposition of the motion? Sir, name and college.
David Brand, Trinity College. First of all, praise the eloquence of all both sides of the House tonight. It's an excellent speaker. But I'm afraid I have to award the debate to the opposition as things stand at the moment, simply because the proposition has not dealt with the fundamental question and issue, which is this House believes God is dead. Now, by his very nature, God is supposed to be immortal, and God therefore cannot die. He cannot have been alive and have died. God has to be, if God exists, he has to be alive. And if he doesn't exist, then he can't have died. So my point is simple.
Any speeches in abstention of the motion? Please.
Lisa Gross, Trinity Hall. I don't want to talk about the issue of whether or not God is dead, but I'd like to challenge the first speaker of the opposition, Mr. Green. So you told us that religion, and Christianity in particular, is the ultimate and only source of morality. And you also said that if we were to kill God, i.e. sort of reject the church, then we wouldn't be any happier. But I'd like to challenge these points in a way that I'm sure you'd appreciate by using Monty Python's. I'm sure you know the sketch, No One Expects the Spanish Inquisition, or the Holy Grail, the line, we need to ban her, she's a witch, because she looks like one. It's actually historically proven that the Catholic Church has killed more people than communism and fascism together. Now, I personally think that's just because of communism and fascism. That they didn't have quite as much time as the Catholic Church.
Just give them more time!
If there is one, and if there is an ultimate source for morality, surely that's good.
Another speaker in proposition of the motion from this side of the room, maybe. You, sir. Name and college.
Ali Jacob, Jesus College. Mr. Gookley made a pretty pertinent point about humility, how science is lacking in it. But if we are to look objectively at what Islam, Christianity, each are individually proclaiming, they're saying we as believers are privy to information that will allow us to be saved, while everyone else who doesn't believe it will burn in hell for eternity. That is the opposite of humility. That is arrogance and privilege on the greatest scale possible.
May I respond?
No. If you leave it to the final speaker. And one final speech from the floor in opposition of the motion. Sir, name and college, please.
I'm a religious person, and worse than terrible, I'm a Catholic. But I'm also a scientist, and regarding the scientific evidence, as soon as we try to find God, as was before by second speaking opposition, we have a problem of definition. In that sense, we cannot apply the scientific method. In any case, Newton was also a Christian, by many means a fundamental he was only able to define the gravitational theory through Christian frameworks, in the sense that he viewed the world as something that he could understand because God had given him the right to accept. which is fundamental in the evolution of modern society. Moreover, the morality issue, there was an article in New Scientist, nonetheless, that said that actually it is proven scientifically and objectively that religion provides a higher level of morality in societies. So, in a sense, it's the only source, well, that's a philosophical debate, but it's definitely a very relevant and important source. And finally, the fact that the proposition is arguing that God should be dead, but they're not arguing the fact that God is in fact very much alive in today's world and will continue to be alive in society and its evolution. Thank you.
And may I call to the box the final speaker in proposition of the motion, Dennis Collins.
Thank you, Mr. President. The President didn't say the reason I'm here. I'm the chairman of QAS, Cambridge University Atheist and Agnostic Society. And I didn't know I was going to be speaking at this event. I thought I was going to come as a punter and do what some of you have been doing, stand up and try and put the opposition off. So I didn't know I'd actually get 15 minutes. So I only found this out about 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock this morning. So as a combination of that, my pathological laziness... And also the fact that my fellow propositioners, if it's such a word, and also some of the people who've made objections have actually covered quite a lot of what I want to say. So we could go to the pub now. Well, what do you think?
Are you buying?
No. There's an MP here. The last MP I will name names, but he was a Lib Dem MP, and I chaired a talk he gave, and I looked up his information beforehand, and in the previous year, he had received £120,000 in travel expenses alone of taxpayers' money. So they're on you.
I'm not actually an MP.
Whatever. Lib Dem, anyway. Okay. The first thing I'd like to say is that I'm afraid the young guy there stole my thunder because I was going to open this, and I still will because I've got nothing else to open with. Technically, no, God isn't dead because God was never alive. And something can't be dead until it's... being alive, which is obvious, it's just inorganic if it's otherwise or it's non-existent. I'm going to answer, go through some of the points that the opposition have made. I mean, we're told that we believe in God as children, or sometimes we, almost a childlike way, the way we feel, or things, aspects of the world, and we tend to accept that more as God or God's works or whatever, maybe that than we do, you know, later on. I mean, in the Gospels, Jesus famously says, the kingdom of God, come unto me, the children, you have to become childlike and so on. Well, I think I can understand that in a psychological way, although I don't think it's literally true. I think I did believe in God when I was very young, but it's very hazy. I know I believed in Santa Claus up till I was three, but not much after. And I don't mean this in a rude way, but I think I gave up belief in God not very long after that. I had almost, if this isn't a contradiction in terms... a Catholic fundamentalist upbringing, not through my family, but through my schools. But since the era I grew up in, only the only half-decent schools were Catholic, I went to those. And one of my very first memories, when I would have been 4 years old in late 1977 or early 78, and Sister Eileen, our teacher, said to me, "Dennis, why weren't you and your family at Mass last night? It must have been Monday morning." And I said, "Oh, but Sister, I couldn't go because the Muppet Show was on." Now, she wasn't very impressed with this. Now, those of you who remember the Muppet Show, or certainly the older people here from the first run, will know that I had a good point. That was a good idea. I remember Sister Annie saying, "But Dennis, you've got to understand very solemnly, you know, God is more important than the Muppet Show." And that was the first that I can remember, but not the last time somebody lied to me about religion. I shouldn't say lie because she probably thought it was true, but I don't think it was true. You're talking about an openness. We have to be open. Well, to a point we do, but of course, if you're too open-minded, then your brain becomes a skip and people throw rubbish into it. And this is a real problem. And I think that you talked about, and again, somebody else picked up on this point, you talked about... the scientific enlightenment, rational, whatever we want to call it, worldview, we should have a little bit of humility. Well, I agree with that. I do agree with that. We don't know everything, and we probably never will know everything, but because we don't know everything doesn't mean we know nothing. You know, we know enough now. It doesn't matter what future advances science makes. the Earth isn't going to turn out to be about 6,000 years old, right? No possible future advance is going to bring that about. Theoretically it could, but if we're talking sensibly, it's not going to happen. We don't know what most of the universe is made of. Dark matter, exotic matter, whatever. It doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference. We're not going to find out the Earth is the centre of the universe, and we're not going to find out it's flat, and we're not going to find out that, and this is with apologies to Stephen, but we're not going to find that actually ourselves and all the living things are built by an intelligent designer, because we know it's not true. We have masses of evidence, incontrovertible evidence, which, and I know about falsification and all that, but in any sensible use of the term, it is true, it is proof. And the reason I mention these things is that the Bible, and I'm just picking the Bible because I happen to know most about that particular religious tradition, but religious traditions, and in fact all pre-scientific, pre-enlightenment or non-enlightenment traditions, ways of viewing the world, were wrong about all these fundamental questions. They were wrong in every case. They weren't partnership.
Would you disagree with the Emerson Christian. You said that half, if God, if science can prove or disprove God, then half of his colleagues must be enormously stupid.
I'm going to have to think about that. Okay, so what you're saying is because a lot of scientists are religious. Is that
yes,
okay.
Would you consider that no scientist can possibly be religious?
Oh, no, by no means. No, well, that's empirically not the case. I mean, we've had a few ask people like John Polkinghorne, for example. Very religious guy, a guy who's now, well, retired now, but an Anglican priest. Oh, there you go. But there's lots like him, he's by no means isolated. No, there's a lot of these people, but I just think that these are people who are, and this does sound arrogant, but in my view, these are people who have somehow managed to do a double thing. They see the scientific worldview, and they know how it works as much as any of us does. But they have this thing in almost every case. You always have a few converts later in life. But in 99% of cases, they were brought up with a particular religious worldview. And it's extremely hard to shake that off. Ironically, for good Darwinian reasons. Because we're all hardwired, our brains, to believe what our parents and our elders tell us when we're very small. Because in an ancestral hunter-gatherer environment, if you didn't listen, if you didn't believe your parents when they said, don't go down to the pool, you'll drown, or you'll get eaten by a monster, keep away from snakes and so on. If you didn't do that, you wouldn't last very long. Those of our ancestors survived because they had the propensity to do that. And I think that is a big part of that factor with scientists. I'm waffling more than usual, but the QS people are used to that. Just one thing, Mr. President, I thought you might need like St. John's ambulance, because I thought a few QS people might faint seeing me in a tie. I got the email this morning saying black tie, and I haven't possessed a tie. I went through like a Bosnian wardrobe, and I found this. This was my last school tie. Millions of years ago. So there you go. You said that. I mean, the scientific description is not enough of the universe. Well, strictly speaking, I think that's true because science can't really tell us what makes a good poem, for example, if we're talking about poetry. But I think, in a way, with respect, that's a bit beside the point because I think theoretically, if we knew enough about how the human mind works and how it interacts with our environment and how we make language, how we process it, I think science probably could tell us what makes a good poem. It's a lack of information rather than anything else. Just because science can't explain something, it's a logical fallacy to think, well, therefore something else must. And this is something that a lot of people even today seem to find hard to grasp. So you can't explain how we should live. It doesn't mean therefore somewhere, and science can't, incidentally, it doesn't mean therefore somewhere else there is a genuine, authentic, valid body of belief which has something behind it that's objective back in it. It doesn't mean that. Sure.
Sorry, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't, or it doesn't mean the opposite to what you say. Are you atheist or agnostic?
I'm an atheist.
Yeah. And why non-agnosticism?
Because in the same way that I'm an Santa Clausist, I'm an unicornist, I'm an fairy at the bottom of the garden. It's like Simon, I'm an equal opportunities atheist, right? I mean, as I say, I'll go further, I don't believe in ghosts, I don't believe in poltergeists. I suffer from epilepsy. According to the Bible, I'm infested with demons, or at least somebody back then had the things I had.
I'm not sure that's actually in the Bible.
Yes, it is, that's You'll find a lot of...
Trust me, someone who's read the Bible and works in mental health, it's not.
No, epilepsy isn't mentioned, but people with mental health issues, who in some cases probably were epileptic, are said to have demons. And Jesus himself, if we believe the Gospels, thought this was true. In regard with that, and also a few other things, Bertrand Russell pithily noted that if the Christian view is right, the Gospels are true, and if Jesus was God, then God would be very ignorant. And I don't mean that in a facetious way. I think it's things you should think about that. While we're on the Bible, I mean, Stephen mentioned, and I'm surprised there hasn't been more of this, Stephen mentioned, well, Christ appeared to numerous witnesses after his resurrection. Well, did he? I mean, we don't have any very good evidence for this. We have ancient documents. The earliest account of a post-resurrection appearance is in Paul. And it was written probably at least 20 years after the supposed alleged time of the death of Jesus, and all it mentions is apparitions. Later on, you have developments in Q, which is an early Christian source. That doesn't have anything about the resurrection. Hebrews, another very early source, only has everything very very vague about apparitions. It's only much later. Mark, the original Gospel Mark, in its original ending, because the ending you'll find in your Bible now isn't original. That's known. That was added later. It doesn't have any post-resurrection appearances. They only come with Matthew and Luke, which were written towards the end of the first century, or maybe just after that. So that's a long time after. So I just thought that should be mentioned.
A point of information. Luke was written by Luke, and he was alive at the time of the first apostles.
No, he wasn't. Almost certainly not.
Oh, okay. Well, take your word for it, Dennis.
Luke's gospel, as we have, canonical Luke, probably wasn't completed to the mid-second century. There was a proto-Luke, which was around in the 80s and 90s, which itself, for various reasons, is known not to have been written by an eyewitness, mainly because it uses Mark as a main source and Q.
What books have you been reading properly?
Well, we can talk about it afterwards, okay, along with Monty Python. Yes. Okay. A point of order against my own side, I'm going to have to squeeze this in. Newton wasn't the greatest, because Darwin was. Newton wasn't because he spent more time studying the Book of Revelations, and he spent more time studying astrology than he ever did science. So it's pretty amazing what he did in science. And he was a very nasty man. He had a terrible go at Leibniz, and accused him of pinching the calculus off him, which didn't happen. Darwin, another Cambridge man, so we're covered. Darwin's the greatest man who has ever lived, because he came up with what has since proven to be the correct explanation for our existence, the mechanism of how ourselves and all living things came to be. I have no doubt if humanity survives a few more millennia, Darwin... Sure.
Does it answer why questions? It answers how. Exactly. Why? That's a fundamental thing.
Well, absolutely. It is. Okay, no, sure. That's true. I still think it's pretty good. Anyway, that was just to get back at him, okay? Okay. You said, I wasn't quite sure what you meant by this, but let's see if I did get it right. You said something about an argument from silence. Well, we'd made an argument from silence. We seem to be making an argument from silence of this side. Could you just amplify that?
Can I clarify? The argument from silence would be to say, if we don't know about it, it's not there. Yeah, and what I'm saying is that the very nature of scientific inquiry, and indeed of Enlightenment philosophical inquiry, is that it's a specific series of tasks asking certain questions of a certain portion of nature with a set of a priori assumptions, which produces results in its given sphere and answers probably the how question rather than the why question. Okay. It's about, but what an argument from silence would be to say, we haven't personally at the moment got any evidence of X, Y, or Z, ergo, it's not there. Now, that just doesn't work. Obviously, there was an argument from silence that there was no North America, from the European point of view, until they bumped into it, at which point they revised the thing. So you can't, you can't argue the non-existence of something as effectively or securely as you can argue what you know about what does exist.
I think that's perfectly true, but again, just because we don't know everything doesn't mean we know nothing. I mean, maybe come back to Occam's razor. Before Darwin, before people like Hume as well, and before modern cosmology, it was reasonable, it was plausible to believe in a creator God, because that seemed an awful lot to explain. I would argue, and I hope most people here would agree on this at least, But that is no longer the case. I mean, you might have other reasons for believing in God, but I hope you wouldn't hold those things. We now know in broad outline, not in every detail, we never will know every detail, but in broad outline, we now know everything from a fraction of the second, roughly how things happened from a fraction of a second after the Big Bang till today. There's nothing in the universe now we look at. We've got absolutely no idea how it could have come about. We've got some reasonably good ideas. Now, once you get down to quarks and leptons and superstrings and who knows what else will come up, they're so simple that they don't seem to...
Is that string theory is simple moment?
No, but individually, they're so simple. Well, if you want to argue that you need an infinitely, or at least incredibly complex creator in order to create them, in order to produce them, then you're not solving, you're not answering a question, you're not solving anything. You're just pushing the problem back a stage and you're making it bigger. You're changing a mystery into a super mystery. So I don't think the argument from science that you're mentioning is valid. I think we applied Occam's razor, and until and unless somebody comes up with something that suggests strongly that there is a God, a need for a God, a deity of some kind, we should assume that it's not. That should be our default position. And that is, I think, what everyone on this side would agree with.
On that point,
yep.
Occam did believe in God, so his razor may be misapplied at this point.
No, it's not. It's
he seems to be cutting away more than just God using the scientific method.
Okay.
I'm not sure you have any room left for proving the existence of love, unless it's just kind of way out. Or beauty.
Well, also, well, hang on. Okay, sure. Well, ultimately, I think love is a chemical reaction, but at one level, in the same sense that you and I throw away DNA survival machines, at one level, it doesn't mean we don't have some intrinsic value. It's just that I'm arguing that there isn't, to be blunt, there isn't some ethical yardstick in the sky that we measure these things against. That's what
my
I'm
wife
arguing.
Would be thrilled by that.
Fair enough. We were told as well that you were defending God rather than religion, which is fair enough. But again, I think, you know, we were talking about, and this came up, and a lady over there mentioned this, you know, we talk about the horrible things that, what I would call these... Okay. I'll see you later, okay? we were talking about the really horrible things that, what I would call these pseudo... religious, the pseudo-religions of things like Marxist-Leninism, Nazism, fascism, and so on did in the last century, and still in parts of the world today, the likes of North Korea is still going on. I don't think it's helpful to get into debate. Did the Catholic Church manage to kill more people that it didn't like than Pol Pot did, you know, in a shorter space of time? I mean, it seems to me that whenever these ideologies, both religious, pseudo-religious, are totalitarian, if they get their way, they'll just crush all opposition, and human rights don't seem to matter. And so that's a good reason for secular humanism, I think. And the fact that God is dead, or was never alive in my view, really is neither here nor there. The Holocaust, yeah, more Jews died in the Holocaust than any other time in history, but there were lots of pogroms against Jews by both Catholics and Protestants through Europe, through the Middle Ages and the early modern period. They never managed to kill millions of them, but because they managed to kill hundreds, occasionally thousands. They didn't have railways, they didn't have cattle trucks, they didn't have gas chambers and crematoria. That's what the 20th century brought. And I think it's almost, I don't know, I can imagine a parallel universe where the theistic religions were more powerful in the 20th century when science and technology produced the means for mass murder, and they did those things. So I think when those who are religious point to these non-religious, anti-religious, pseudo-religious, whatever you want to call them, totalitarian states, I think they should be very careful and look at their own record. Okay. Just and at this point, this will be the last thing now. I mean, you talked about primitive peoples, as you know, we glibly might call them, or certainly used to be called Aboriginal peoples, as we call them now. And you said something about an atheist narrative is all about growing up. I think sort of as a species or as a culture, society. Primitive people are seen as there to be taught and patronised and exploited. And I think that has certainly happened, and you find certain people in the Enlightenment writing that. But you'll find that with the religions as well. I mean, you know, it's been the news lately because it's the bicentenary. But the Church of England for several centuries was immensely enriched by slavery. Immensely enriched. And, you know, I'm not saying no one here tonight has done it, but it gets my goat when Christian groups go on about how wonderful they were, their forefathers got rid of slavery. Well, a few of the dissenters, usually people like Quakers on the edges of the faith, not usually from the main churches, they got rid of slavery along with Enlightenment thinkers. All these things, and most of what we enjoy now as civil rights, came about through and after the Enlightenment. They didn't come about in the 1500 years that Christianity had total hegemony over Western civilization. When Christianity became dominant in the late 4th century in Rome, what it brought was the Dark Ages. Well, over 95% of the writings of pagan antiquity were deliberately destroyed by Christians because they didn't agree with the Bible. And it took another 1,000 years to catch up again. So once again, I think that should be remembered. And that's probably about enough. I could go on a bit longer, but you've probably had enough. So God isn't technically dead because he wasn't alive, but I'd still very much like to vote for us. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, rounding up tonight's debate is Martin Turner, the chair of the Liberal Democrat Christian Forum. Please join me in welcoming him to the stand.
So it's great to be here. I've never actually been to Cambridge before. I went to the other place. Didn't join. Oh, sorry. I've got to get it out. As a Liberal Democrat, I'm well used to kind of seeing a sea of people wearing Tory badges or Labour badges and sort of wondering whether there's a yellow badge somewhere, and there never is one, apart from if I brought it. I really loved hearing what you had to say, and I loved the rhetoric, even though I didn't agree with the content. I'd like to characterise the three things we've heard tonight from this side. I wouldn't presume to characterise from this side. As the epidemiological argument from Dennis, the scientific argument, and the rhetorical argument. Now, that might sound patronising, but actually I think that's probably the strongest one. The epidemiology is a word I learned when I joined the NHS 7 years ago. I was a bit confused. I thought I was getting a free health plan. But epidemiology is what we do in public health. When we can't actually work out if fluoridation is bad for you or good for you, or if thalidomide is actually a dangerous drug or not. Because, of course, the experiments done by the drug companies will always demonstrate absolutely conclusively, which you'll know if you've seen The Constant Gardener, that the drug's perfectly safe. I live in the West Midlands, I live in Birmingham, and we've had fluoridation in the water for about 30 or 40 years. And I know lots of people, most of them are Liberal Democrats, because if you want to find some weird people with weird beliefs that they're very, very keen on, talk to Lib Dems. If you want to get bored in a pub, ask somebody about single transferable vote. And it doesn't matter who you ask, because all the Liberal Democrats in the pub will sort of crane over and join in the conversation. Eventually, you and your mate will have gone off, and they'll be still trying to argue about 80 plus. But I know lots of people will tell me that, chemically speaking, fluoridation in the water will cause osteoporosis, and that this is going to be a terrible thing. But the fact is, what you do in public health is you actually look at as long a track record as possible, and you don't say what would happen, but what did happen. And as it happens, apparently it doesn't cause really anything apart from saving your teeth. Thalidomide, on the other hand, over quite a short period, causes terrible mutations in pregnancy. The epidemiological argument against Christianity and against Islam and against theism in general is more or less this: that look at all the terrible things that Christians or Muslims or other isms have done, and that is therefore evidence that it's all a bad thing. And I don't think I'm mischaracterizing you by saying that's the basic thrust of what you're saying. Unfortunately, you cannot apply epidemiology to anything really apart from public health, which is why people don't usually do it, because there are far too many other factors. I rang up my ex-fiance because...
Should we ask?
I can hear confession later.
Absolutely. Well, which time? She's an atheist. And actually a Labour Party candidate. That's not when we split up. She wasn't. Or a Labour Party candidate when we split up. And I rang up and I said, look, tell me why you were an atheist. And we had this discussion all week. And she actually said, look, the epidemiological argument, she doesn't use that word because she's not in public health. she said, of course, advertising. But it didn't work for her. And we talked about communism, and I really am a bit suspect about that, you know, historically proven that they... We'll look it up later. It's on Wikipedia. Anyone knows that? It took Christianity 11 centuries to degenerate to the point of the Crusades. And it took it 7 centuries after it kind of acquired political power. It took atheism about 2.5 centuries to degenerate to the gulags, and much less than after it acquired power. Does that prove anything? No, it doesn't.
On that point?
Yeah, okay.
Hitler was a vegetarian. Does that mean that all vegetarians are mass murderers?
But you make my point for me. You exactly make my point for me. You actually cannot conclude on this basis, but thank you. You can't conclude. And as my ex-fiance pointed out, she's Welsh, by the way, as well as being an atheist in a late part of it. She pointed out that actually Stalin was coming in from a background of Russian Orthodoxy, and he came with all this baggage. And I'm sure that the people in the Crusades could have made the same claims. I'm not personally convinced people went to the Crusades for Christian reasons. It's very difficult to verify, or indeed to falsify, or anything else so far. Apart from emulsify perhaps. or emulsification. Is that emulsification by grace? Sorry, please do.
More recent instance which really cannot be attributed to anything other than religion, in this particular instance, Catholicism, by its opposition to contraception. The Catholic Church has caused far more deaths from AIDS than Hitler managed in the Holocaust or Stalin managed by collectivization.
But you still... No, go on, that's good. You still can't use epidemiology. The fact that things are more recent always makes them more true. But you can't use that. Basically, the epidemiological argument, because you can't actually apply causality to it, doesn't tell you anything. So let's move on to... So you don't want to move on?
Can you apply epidemiology to prisons in the UK?
Oh, that's a very, very good point. I wouldn't want to apply it right now, but actually, I think that's a really interesting point. Now, with my little girl, pattern, if you want to be bored about STD later on in the pub, I think that's a really interesting point. I think there are a lot of things in social science where, although you can't apply a strict epidemiological perspective, it took me 2 years to work out how to say that word. Epidemiological, not perspective. Actually, in social science, there are other things that you can begin to apply it to as long as you remember that it's a metaphor. But when you get into hard philosophy, it's a metaphor that has been stretched too far, like that metaphor, in fact. So let's talk about I love the way you began, because I was going to begin the same way. I was going to say, let's not have entrenched positions. My ex-fiance said, use those words, don't use entrenched positions. So it's going to be a sterile debate, because all the kind of Christian-y sort of people are going to come in with their fish badges or your cross badges. Can I see any fish or cross badges?
I got one.
Steve's got one, thank you. And all the atheists are going to come with kind of absence of a fish badge. It's like the argument of silence. And actually, you probably never cross the borders. But I love the way you began. But then you said, so come over to our side because it's more open-minded. No! You can't say, let's have an open-minded debate, and then say, and come over to our side because it's more open-minded. But I get this from conservatives and Labour people, and even our own people, every day of the week. It's that let's be open-minded, let's have an open-minded debate, and therefore you'll agree with us because what we say is obviously true. Everybody who came in, that's applauding. I did like the lightning theory of falsifiability. I'm sorry, but claiming that atheism is falsifiable by the fact that lightning could strike and the stars could rearrange themselves into words saying there is a God, actually falsifies anything is complete rubbish. But it was very nice. It was good. I loved it. I remember that, and I will use it, I suspect, in the same way you use the one-a-day theory of anthropomorphism to dismiss that particular theory. The world goes round once a day. enough of that. It was a straw man, and you put it as a straw man. I won't penalise you unduly for that. I wish I could write clearly. If I'd only become a pharmacist or a GP, I'd be much wealthier than I am now, but I didn't. I actually studied English. In fact, I studied medieval English. That's not strictly true. I was on the course for English. And I occasionally went to the medieval English lectures. And I've really got to cast some doubt over these claims that Christians have built on these books. But we can talk about manuscripts. We can talk about instant iconography in the secular manuscripts of the 5th and 9th century later on. Okay. That's what I did very well in. That's one bit I paid attention on. Anyway, if you are advancing the argument that science is the measure of religion, then I think you were. I think what you actually said was that I can't read it. It's completely. Who wrote this? Get the guy sat. Over dinner, we kind of tried to do the entire Yorkshireman sketch. But as none of us are actually Yorkshire, I was actually born in West Yorkshire, but I lived there for 4 years. So I'm only the real Yorkshireman here. But you're saying science works. Yes, it does. But this does not make it the measure of all things. I think that point's been made.
Could I clarify?
Yes, please do.
I don't disagree at all with what Dr. White said. I just think his definition is so broad that we can't even have a debate with that definition.
No, I wasn't going to go for his definition. I love what he said, but I can't remember what he said, so I can't repeat it.
My point was that with the conventional definition of God as, you know, somebody who's sort of as something a little more precise than the feeling of awe you get from music.
Is that the conventional definition of God?
Look, that's a slightly less broad definition, one which we can actually debate about. With a slightly less broad definition of God, my argument was we don't need God. I mean, we don't need the crutch.
Okay, I think you're picking up. We're going to have a free-for-all fight in a minute. But I don't stop. I think you're picking up a different thing than what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you advance science as the way to measure religion, and you just can't do that. And have you seen Dead Poets Society? Isn't it kind of gauche now? It's quite cool when it came out. Robin Williams is this kind of a great literature teacher who comes to some kind of school that didn't know what was coming to it. And he's got this book, which I understand really was a textbook about literature, about measuring poems. And yeah, rubbish. You can't look at things like philosophy and the arts scientifically. You cannot look at the question of is this syllogism accurate? Socrates is a Greek. All Greeks are men, and therefore is Socrates from Basingstoke, or whatever it is. Science follows that on. You begin, as somebody points out, with an axiom. And if your axiom is a naturalistic position, well, you can check that, but it's
not
true.
Starts with axioms, science doesn't.
No, it
does. No, it does.
You can't have science without some basic axioms, like the universe is sufficiently consistent to be investigated by logic. Mm. That is an action, you've got to have it. And there are some others as well. We're not going to explore it because I'll get out of my depth really quickly. But you said, as soon as you start advancing science as a measure of all things, then, yeah, it becomes a sterile debate. However, I've got a vacuum on this one. I think that the biggest argument against particularly Christianity is the complete knot many Christians have tied themselves in over evolution. I was brought up with evolution. My dad did a degree in botany and biblical studies. It's just the bees on the list of you. But I was brought up, he told me much later on, he didn't want to push religion down my throat. So he never answered any question about religion. I got all kinds of weird ideas about religion from all kinds of other people. But it wasn't until much later, after reading his books, I found out about religion. But I learned everything there was to know about O-level biology when it was O-level. Before I was about 9, I believed in evolution long before I even believed. I never believed in Easter Bunny. We didn't have that. We were deprived. I've always believed in evolution, apart from a brief flirtation with creation science at the age of 18 and a half for 9 months. And you've got to come back and say, well, any kind of science which begins with the premise that whatever the question is, the answer is it wasn't evolution, it was creation, is bad science. Now, I bought Richard Dawkins' book this week. It was only $8.99. I didn't really want to give him the money, but it's like a big issue seller. But But I did buy it. I saw your website. And I read what you said about it. I read what Terry Eagleton said about it. And I thought, I want to meet these men. So I've met you now. Now I want to meet Terry Eagleton. I read Richard Dawkins' book. I'm sorry, but I had the same feeling reading Richard Dawkins that I'd use a Liberal Democrat reading the Daily Mail. there's a kind of smug certainty. I'm sure he doesn't mean to be smug, but it comes across that way. And then in chapter 4, it says, oh, the core of my debate is... And I'm reading, and chapter 4 suddenly finished, and I still haven't got the arguments. I go back and read it again and again, and I still didn't find the argument. Maybe he's got really strong reasons, and I'm sure you can tell me what they are, for believing what he does, but they're not in that book. However, I was talking to a biologist friend of mine who works in public health, and she can say even more longer words than epidemiology. And I was talking about this, buying a photocopy this afternoon when I was preparing to come out. I only got the email this morning at 6 a.m. saying it's black tie, so I had to rush around my cupboard and try and find a black tie. I think I'm slightly more conventional, but...
I'll dare you.
But it's a great tie, it's a great tie.
I thought it was white collar.
Well, white collar workers. Well, I thought the union, the Cambridge Union. I mean, comrades, everybody else, but they wise up to that. Put on the floor. Anyway, so I was going to cook it, and I said, I'm going to the Cambridge Union tonight. And she knew what it was, which really put me in my place. She said, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm talking about the proposition, this house that believes that God is dead, and I'm speaking against it. And she said, oh, you're not an intelligent design person, are you? And then her phone rang, it was her parents in Canada. So I went away and thought about it, and I came back and had a bit of a chat, and I had an epiphany. So I suddenly saw the world from her perspective, which is that she doesn't really mind that much about religion, it doesn't bother her that much, but she really cares about biology. And you've got these Christians coming in who don't know anything about biology whatsoever. They're not all ignorant, but most of them seem to be. The particular ones that have blogs seem to be particularly ignorant. my dad can study botany, biblical studies and blogs, but it didn't exist then. Coming in, kind of trampling all over the flowers, and there was a nice thing on Radio 4 this afternoon about the pepper moth, and how some Christians had taken a question about some of the experiments as proof that pepper moth didn't prove anything. It's all complete rubbish. Let me tell you this. I still believe in evolution, and I still believe in the Bible, and I really have yet to find the Christian who can convince me that the two are necessarily inconsistent, and I certainly haven't even had found atheists when we talk about it. You have to read Genesis 1 in a particular way, which is particularly compatible with the 1603 King James Version in English, in order to get out of it what the Christians got out of it in the great debates in Darwin's time. And as a Christian, I wish to apologise on behalf of all Christians for just being ignorant and upsetting on that particular issue. However, inasmuch as you accept that... science now explains a process which people didn't believe could happen for how life came about, you've also got to accept that the three basic questions, if you've got two axioms, the two propositions, which are there is a God or there is no God, and law of the excluded middle, Dummett might complain about it, but law of the excluded middle, it's one or the other, and you can pursue either one. If you're going to be really open-minded about it, you need to pursue them on their own merits. So beginning with naturalistic science, which excludes God before you begin, you're going to come round to there being no God. It's a circular argument. However, if you pursue them, the three questions I think you need to ask are, one, how is it that there is a universe at all? Jean-Paul Sartre said the biggest problem, the biggest question in philosophy is, why is there anything at all? Except because it said it in French, I can't remember how it goes. I can tell lots of jokes in French, but no philosophical quotations. The second question is, how does it have the form it has now? And the third question is how does either one of these two axioms square with the character of human beings, or human beings, if you want to be kind of PC, in the way we experience them? And traditionally, classical atheism, well, when I say classical, I mean kind of 18th, 19th century atheism, said, you do not need to explain the beginning of the universe, because it had no beginning. The traditional atheist position, which you see still in the writings of Mackey in the 20th century, is that you don't need to explain it, because there wasn't a beginning. And the traditional Christian position was, yes, but look at creation, look at all the wonderful trees and the flowers and the birds and stuff. Doesn't that point to intelligent design? And they crossed over, because cosmologists now talk about not just a beginning of the universe, they can even tell you what time it was, though not how long ago that was. And inasmuch as science has moved away from favouring a Christian position on one side, on the other side it's moved towards it. Is that an argument for anything? No. Because the fact that you have identified the process by which things came to be does not mean you identified the purpose or the person, or lack of person. Well, not all of you. Go on, you go first. If I actually said anything like that, yes, it would have been. I don't think I said that. Does anybody else think I said that? Ooh. I have them both in the same one. What about your point?
Why should we believe anything religion has to say on the subject?
On what subject?
Of the origin of the universe, the purpose of the universe, etc.
Well, I'm not saying you should. if you want to explore the origin of the universe, you've got basically two choices. You can go with what your particular religion or a religion says about it, or you can explore it scientifically. As religion isn't about identifying the process by which the universe came to be, religion isn't going to help you very much. Science, on the other hand, is brilliant for this. That's what it's really good at, as well as gene therapy and stuff like that. On the other hand, if you want to understand how people exist and how things like love exist and what morality is or isn't, and that's something you have to explore what we usually call the spiritual. And even if you're an atheist and don't want to use the word spiritual, you're going to have to find another word to describe that area of life which science can't investigate. Now, I'm not saying that's the evidence for the existence of God. All I'm saying is I'm really sorry on behalf of Christians everywhere, not that they're all sorry, that we kind of messed around offering what was essentially a bogus objection to evolution. Well, we shouldn't have done.
Should we accept it?
I think we should accept it.
We'll accept it.
Thank you. However, it has nothing to say whatsoever about the validity or not of theism in general, or of Christianity in particular, or of any other Genesis-inspired book. I was really hoping you'd come with Hail Bop, because it was in your papers, but you didn't. Sorry, don't answer that one. The allegation that faith in God is not falsifiable is not a falsifiable allegation. And you should therefore treat it with some suspicion. I'm a Christian today, and probably will be next Friday as well, because of my reading of the New Testament, and because of what I think that narrative tells me about events which I... someone give you two terms of archaeology, have come to believe is good evidence about some things that happened then, plus what the main narrators of the New Testament, like Jesus, have to say about me. That is what is compelling for me. Now, if you want to kind of get involved in all this kind of evangelical stuff, which is where I'm coming from, sorry, I really am one of those people, then we'll talk about it afterwards. But basically, it's not about me sitting on my potty at the age of 2 or in the back of some car at the age of 22 saying, I wonder if there's a God. Rather, what hits me out of the New Testament is sufficiently compelling. And if you're kind of open-minded about this, I would urge you to read that book, well, a collection of books, and make your own mind up. And if you are open-minded and you make your mind up differently, that's your choice. And as a good liberal Democrat, I urge you to exercise your choice at the ballot box of the club. Leaving off topic here. I'm kind of a long digression, like the digressions in Beowulf, which are longer than the poem. The notion is this house believes that God is dead. And I think they've already kind of admitted that they can't make that motion. The words of the motion are, this has to be that God is dead, but as we have seen, as my history teachers love to say, as we have seen, either there is a God, in which case he can't be dead. Good technological argument. I never actually thought anybody would make any sense of it whatsoever. Or there wasn't a God, so he couldn't be dead. If you want to make the motion literally, now I'm kind of wrapping up now, I'm on the stride now. If you want to make the motion literally, you've got to prove there was a God and something really nasty happened to him, her, it, at least 7 years ago, or you actually saw it happening. Because otherwise, you haven't made the motion. If, however, you want to make it metaphorically, well, let's just go in a literary fashion first. Nietzsche, yeah? Nietzsche's the guy who says, God is Todd. And I thought Todd was an Australian guy I used to know, but apparently means God is dead. then actually that's not the argument you're putting forward. And Stephen started on that, but no one kind of really took him up on it. Nietzsche's not really in fashion these days as a moral philosopher because of those who came after him and perhaps falsely appealed to his philosophy. And also like the music of Wagner. But somebody got it. Thank you. If you want to take it that way, then okay, but nobody seems to want to. You could take it metaphorically and say, well, it's a metaphor for there being no God. Well, you should have specified that. I mean, Tony Blair could have said, well, you know, when we said there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, what we meant was metaphorical weapons of mass destruction. Ignorance, tyranny, enslavement, oppression. I'm sorry, Tony, but that weren't any. And if you're really saying, well, actually, although the motion is that this house believes that God is dead, we're saying this house is basically atheistic, I'm sorry, you haven't made the motion. If you want to make it metaphorically, it's a false perspective, it's a jet straw Horlicks, you can't have it. And you should punish them for not defining that, or at least making reference to it. Or you could say, we mean it ironically. I bet George W. is sitting at home right now, thinking, you know, I only attacked Iraq ironically, and I'm going to attack ironically next. Go ahead, please do.
Yes, I think the last time, or perhaps it was the penultimate time I debated in this house, Malcolm Rifkin was on the other side, and the motion was about whether religion is the opium of the people.
So
we were doing pretty
John
well,
Gummer.
And we were doing quite. Oh yes, sorry, John Gummer, and we were doing quite well. And then John Gummer made the lovely debating trick of saying, no, religion couldn't be the opium of the people because you smoked opium through a pipe. You didn't take religion through a pipe. Yeah. And this seems to be exactly the rhetorical move you're making now.
Yeah, it's just a little trick at the end. Yeah. But he's quite right. And if you recall, I began by characterising this as the epidemiological approach, the scientific approach, and the rhetorical approach. So I thought I might pay a little tribute with a rhetorical flourish. I don't believe that this side has made a case that there is no God.
On your point.
Well, I haven't made it yet. I don't believe they've made that case. However, if you were kind of thinking of voting for the motion anyway on a rhetorical grounds, let me urge you not to. I love what you said, but for the same reason that Malcolm says, you know, yeah, great, I agree with most of that. I agree that most of those things are absolutely right, which is why I'm, as he said, not defending religion but God. Actually, I'm not even defending God. I'm simply making the case that you haven't made the case that there isn't a God. I've not heard anything compelling. Nothing which beats chapter 4 of Richard Dawkins' book has been said tonight. If you think you've made that case, then turn that afterwards, but I don't think you did. And if you want to make the case, this has to believe that God is dead, or translates into that there is no God, there never was a God, or if there is a God, it's such a vague term, it doesn't mean a thing. I don't believe that case has been made tonight. I'm not claiming to have made the case that there is a God. I personally believe there is a God, and I also personally believe that you can make the case and you could do it. How about something we're called to do tonight? I'm simply claiming that case that there is not a God. The Welsh rugby team. The answer is certainly coming up. The case hasn't been made, and therefore, when you go to the ballot box, what do you call it here?
The division lobby,
thank you very much. When you go to the division lobby, I think you should go on the nay side and say, no, that case was not made. On the other hand, you may have begun with an entrenched position, in which case you're going to go, whichever side you were going to go, yeah. I can't stop you. And all we're really doing is then doing a statistical, almost an epidemiological analysis of who came into the room tonight. I don't think that's a very useful exercise. Vote with what case has been made. I don't believe the case has been made. There isn't a God. I've heard it asserted beautifully. I would allege questionably. But I haven't heard it asserted convincingly. Thank you very much, you've been great.
Firstly, I'd like to thank six fantastic speakers for tonight's debate. Before you vote, I've got some very, very quick society announcements. Shut Up and Dance, our weekly club night tomorrow. The Life of Brian,
People from Judea!
And next week we've got the former Regency family of Hungary. The bar will be open after the debate. We've got brand new computer facilities, so if you want to check how many people were actually killed during the, you can. And before any further ado, it's come to the voting. Eyes to the right, nose to the left, abstentions down the centre, and the results will be read out in the bar afterwards.
On the motion, this House believes that God is dead, the House divided as follows. Eyes, to the right, 135 votes. Nose, to the left, 172 votes. There were 37 abstentions. The motion failed by a margin of 37 votes. In proposition, the speakers were Prof. Simon Blackburn, Rahul Nandkishore, Dennis Collins. In opposition, the speakers are Stephen Green, Dr. Malcolm Guide, Martin Turner. The president in the chair was Roland Foxcroft. This debate was recorded at the Cambridge Union Society on Thursday, 11th October 2007, by Richard Neal. Copyright, the Cambridge Union Society, 2007. The redistribution license is Creative Commons, Attribution Non-Commercial, No Derivatives. The website is http://www.cambridgeunion.org.